Hi, everybody, and welcome to Kremlin File. Olga, are we set to go?
Yes, we are. I'm very excited about today's guest.
Yeah, Frank Figliuzzi is coming.
And for Americans, Frank Figliuzzi.
He's a former federal law enforcement agent and the former assistant director for counterintelligence at the FBI, and is currently the national security contributor, as we know, at NBC and MSNBC News.
Frank also has a best-selling book called The FBI Way, Inside the Bureau's Code of Excellence, which is a really, really good book.
Frank is also the host to his own podcast, The Bureau. And each episode explores U.S. security issues, so he talks with insiders in and around the intelligence community, law enforcement, and the military, which is perfect for us because today we're going to be talking, okay, about the J6 hearings that we've all been watching, glued to the TV. So without any further ado, huge, huge welcome to Frank Figliuzzi. Hi, Frank.
Ah, you've used the Italian pronunciation. I can tell you've got some Italian background.
Yeah. Well, I'm here in Siena, Frank.
Ah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Now, the committee, Frank, has presented a lot of information, a lot of evidence up until now of this conspiracy, okay, to overthrow the elections. In your opinion, is there anything that has emerged up until now that could lead to some sort of criminal prosecution?
So I'm going to answer your last question first, because that's the big one, right? And the answer succinctly is yes. Yes, I think we are seeing evidence of crimes here. And, you know, to the extent that every day so far for the hearings has been a kind of hybrid between a made-for-television drama and a criminal grand jury presentation, I think this is leaning more toward a criminal grand jury presentation. And particularly what we saw on Thursday was indeed a very adept attempt to carve out any sense of defense that Eastman, Trump, others might have that, hey, we were clinging to some legitimate legal theory here. I really believe the committee's done a great job of discounting that theory. It's really, for me, no longer just ignoring truth, but rather making a deliberate choice. You know, we hear prosecutors on television talk a lot about this concept of willful blindness. This is, you know, this is more than willful blindness. This is a choice to do what you know is illegal, period. And you know, so some of the things that jumped out at me that you asked about, look, I spent 25 years within the Department of Justice as an FBI agent. And when you hear the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr, saying repeatedly under oath that he told President Trump, there's no fraud. It's not here. He used very colorful language, right? This is bullshit, he said, right? You can't get more emphatic than that. If you choose to ignore the top lawman in the land, you know you are proceeding illegally. So, you know, on both fronts of possible criminal prosecution, one front being the violence and physical attempts to block certification of the Electoral College vote on January 6th at the Capitol, the other front being all these behind-the-scenes machinations to select alternate electors, to overturn state-by-state results. On those two fronts, I think the committee has done an outstanding job of showing there was no fraud, they knew there was no fraud, and there was a deliberate choice. And then, you know, a harder case, I will admit, a harder case to make is that they knew there was going to be violence and that there was hands-on planning of that. But I have to tell you, we were only into this by three hearings. And I think more is coming.
Yeah. In fact, I was going to ask you about the Proud Boys and also the Oath Keepers, because I remember when I was watching this very, very closely from here, okay, in Italy. And I remember that in the beginning of December, Tario and some of his Proud Boys were at the White House. And I kept saying, what are they doing there? Okay. Now we know, because, I mean, you know, they were planning and plotting and the whole thing, right? And Olga, before we got on, we were talking about also some of the connections, because Russia is also connected to that. Yeah,
especially with Oath Keepers and 3%ers. Russia, after, for those who don't know, Russia took interest in American politics around 2008 after Obama's election, and they saw the divisiveness around it and the racism come out and the insanity. Around 2011, Russia latched on to the Oath Keepers and the famous Yevgeny Prigozhin, who ran the internet research troll farm, actually started helping amplify their messages, creating memes for them to spread. And this has been going on over the past, you know, decade. And I think, you know, it's interesting because you have that. And it was honestly done both to sow discord and division in U.S., but it was also to delegitimize our military, because, you know, the one thing that Russia wants to do is to weaken our military. And by targeting former military members, it would, you know, definitely helps them, as we see right now with Mike Flynn and with the Oath Keepers and all the others who were involved.
Yeah, you know this all good better than anybody, but the Russian intelligence services have always sought to divide us along racial lines. They've had very strategic plans that have been uncovered to do this. You know, you can go back to Martin Luther King and the civil rights era. But I think there's two aspects here that you touch on that I'd love to see the committee move forward with. And I believe they are. They've indicated they are. And that, number one, the foreign involvement in this and the foreign influence campaigns here that got us to where we are. And secondly, which is closely linked, I think, financial backing and funding of the January 6th movement, the attempts to overturn the election. I think we're in for some revelations there. And they have said they are pursuing the financial end of this. So with regard to Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, that would certainly be a bombshell if we found that there was foreign influence and funding there. There's always been a question in my mind as to where their money comes from. You don't buy this kind of weaponry and get the training and the travel just on membership dues alone. And of course, the big thing that everybody should become aware of is that we saw a physical encounter between Enrique Terrio of Proud Boys and Stuart Rhodes of Oath Keepers. That was documented on video in that parking garage just before January 6th. And to me, as a law enforcement guy, I commented on TV, you know, not to be over dramatic, but, you know, if you study the mafia and J. Edgar Hoover, the former director of the FBI, ultimately really coming to the realization that he had been wrong when he kept saying there's no organized mafia in the United States, there's no threat there, this is a bunch of haphazard random people. Well, 1957, upstate New York, the local police trip over a major meeting of mafioso in a town called Appalachian, New York, where over 100 mobsters, including 60 capos, you know, different families, are all in one place having a coordinating meeting. And it changed the way the FBI looked at the mafia and the approach to it as an organized crime threat. And I'm telling you, there is an analogy to what we're facing today for the domestic extremist groups and the threat they pose. They're far more organized and coordinated than we realize.
And speaking of foreign influence,
have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Yeah.
So we all remember the Russian agent Butina, who got around among Republican circles. One of her ex-lovers, Patrick Byrne, who was the Overstock CEO guy, was at the White House in late December in a meeting with Flynn, discussing overthrowing the election using martial law. He was also involved in Dominion. Do you think the committee has looked into this? Because we to date have not heard his name. And it's, you know.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I would be surprised if they aren't at least exploring Patrick Byrne and his connections. We just talked about finances, funding, money, right? You want to talk about the availability of funds. You're talking about someone like a major CEO with wealth, with private jets to transport people. I've had some sources telling me that they think Patrick Byrne's private jet has been used to transport very suspect people, including the possibility that Enrique Terrio may have had a ride or two on a Patrick Byrne jet.
Wow.
Definitive there, but I do think it's at least being explored.
Meanwhile, on the flip side,
they're looking at
on
that.
The flip
it's
side,
crazy.
When Butina was running for Duma, which she eventually won in a very weird election in Russia, they used Patrick Byrne as a case for foreign influence because he was supposedly giving her money. And I'm like, really? They care about foreign influence? Yeah, they cited
that
communist actually tried to make a case that she shouldn't be able to run because of foreign influence and the investments that Patrick Byrne has made into her. And I'm like, really? Okay.
Yeah. Upside down.
Yeah, no, it is. In fact, seen from here, okay, I mean, I do realize probably, I mean, in the United States, this is your government. It was a coup. It was an attempt to overthrow everything. Seen from our side over here, it looked absolutely flipping crazy. What was going on? Okay, if I can use this kind of language with you, Frank, I'm being a bit more open here. The one thing, how do we get, but it's not just the American public, it's also the European public. I think they've understood a little bit, but how do we get the American public to understand that this just wasn't, to overthrow the government? I mean, here they were planning also an assassination attempt. Mm-hmm. Against the vice president.
That line of succession, because it was Pelosi too.
The line. Yeah, all of them. You're absolutely right. It's not just Pence. Because yesterday while I was watching and I said, oh my God, what are these people doing?
Well, a couple of thoughts here for our European friends, really international friends. One, and Barack Obama said this recently in a speech he gave overseas, which was, we take our democracy for granted, and I think everybody does. Ukraine is experiencing a fight for democracy. Literally, that's existential to them. But this is a reminder that if you're sitting back, not engaged, taking your democracy and freedoms for granted, you are making a serious error here. Democracy is a fragile experiment. It is. And it can fail at any moment if it's not monitored carefully. Secondly, let's understand this is not a unique American phenomenon. What happened on January 6th is a reflection of a far greater global movement toward authoritarianism, toward the concept that democracy is failed, and nationalism and violent extremism is certainly not unique to America. I mean, just this week, we've learned that the Canadian authorities conducted a raid on the Atomwaffen division, which is a violent extremist group that they had in Canada. This is everywhere. And, when you have Fox News hosts deciding to host their program for a week
in
Hungary, because Hungary has become an example of what they want to be. And CPAC, Conservative Political Action Committee, decides to hold their meeting in Hungary. That should signal all of us that we are moving toward extremism and fascism and neo-Nazism. Mm-hmm. Just last weekend, we saw in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. I mean, this is, you want to talk about middle America. At a Pride event, this is Pride Month here in the United States, we saw the violent neo-fascist white nationalist group Patriot Front taken down by the police. 31 arrests because this group, again, believing their premise is that democracy has failed and we need authoritarianism, they were about to commit violence at a Pride event. This is a global phenomenon.
Yeah.
No, Can I chime in just because I always have to bring Russia in? So with interesting with Adam Waffen, in 2011, there was an Uzbeki who was living, and by all means, looks like he was an SVR agent, living inside of Moscow, who set up a foreign forum, Iron March. And this Iron March forum that disappeared mysteriously in 2017 basically pulled in all the neo-Nazi groups, including them, from across the world. Mm. And it was like one forum, and it was actually dubbed the Facebook for Nazis. And it was, one forum. So that just shows you Russia's interest in even, you know, despite their denazification claims, of how they work with far-right groups, with Nazi groups, with, you know, ultra-nationalists everywhere, in order to achieve their means and help this push to destroy democracy and rise to authoritarianism. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I always have to chime in with my Russia stuff.
I know. That's your question's next, babe.
So we keep seeing the media, saying, "Oh, Merrick Garland and the Department of Justice are very closely watching these hearings." My question is, why would they be watching these hearings? Wouldn't the FBI have opened an investigation into this right after the Capitol attack? And they have much better tools than.
Yes, they do. There are clear indications, Olga, that we have multiple grand juries sitting, that this absolutely is under investigation by DOJ. The FBI is looking at planning and preparations well beyond the over 800 Americans who've already been indicted for their participation in January 6th. This has moved into the planning preparation phase, no question about it. But to answer your question, look, the committee has had hundreds of interviews of very key players. And why wouldn't DOJ really need to determine whether people are making statements against self-interest, incriminating themselves, whether or not they're lying to the committee, and whether what they're saying is contrary to what the FBI and DOJ have learned already? But there's also what we call lead material. There may well be evidence provided to the committee that simply hasn't come across the radar screen at DOJ yet. And yes, of course, they have powers of subpoena at DOJ. They can arrest people for lying to the FBI. But that's all very kind of hardball and becomes very overt once you start bringing people into the grand jury and leaks start occurring and you start subpoenaing records from banks and phone companies, which, by the way, I think is going on. We know it's been going on with the committee, but it's good news, bad news. You know, you've got this kind of softer approach the committee has had to take because they lack the hard authorities. And there's almost a benefit to that because now the DOJ can say, let's wait and see what this person tells the committee before we go very hard, go in your face, knock on the door type approach. So they complement each other. And just yesterday, as we're taping this, we learned that the DOJ has sent a second letter to the committee saying, we really do need your transcripts now. And I looked at who signed that letter from DOJ and why that letter has come yesterday. It came out of a Proud Boys prosecution in the District of Columbia. So think about that for a second. A Proud Boys prosecution is going on in the district. Both the prosecution and the defense agree that they need the transcripts from the committee for that Proud Boys prosecution. And high-ranking officials at DOJ, including the head of national security, Matt Olson, and also the head of criminal division at DOJ, both signed the letter saying, we have ongoing prosecutions where we need to see your transcripts. Wow. So a lot going on here.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. In fact, yeah, exactly. Well, that makes sense. Exactly. No, it's said in this way, in fact, because one of the things I did want to ask, you know, talking about the key players, right, that you had mentioned and that we saw yesterday, because, you know, we had a lot of high ranking. These are a lot of people that have come forward who have been at the hearings are high ranking individuals that know in the Trump administration. And the one question I wanted to ask, well, why didn't they come forward before? I mean, why did they have to be subpoenaed to get in front? They've all been singing like little birds. So, you know, this is one aspect to it. And is it because I started thinking about it, I said, well, maybe they're afraid now they're going to be prosecuted themselves. So why not cooperate at this moment before other evidence comes out and I'm going to have to defend myself? I don't know. This is my simple way of thinking about it, but I don't know if that's
well,
the way
I think
it
the
is.
People, I mean, we're all asking some serious questions about why didn't people come out sooner? First of all, why do we have to hear this now? And, you know, for example, we're kind of lauding Vice President Pence for doing the right thing. Of course, yes, of course he did. But, if he had come out publicly and said, I'm being pressured under pain of death and my, you know, I'm being threatened to that my career is over. And I want everybody to know, you know, this is illegal what I'm being asked to do. Things would have been different. Same for Bill Barr. Bill Barr, you know, resigns and writes a glowing letter to Trump. Hey, thanks for
exactly.
serving.
Exactly. Justo.
Been a pleasure. Yes. Been a pleasure serving with you. You know.
Yeah.
Really. Really. Yeah. I get it. I get the conundrum of trying to keep the country together, trying to be loyal to the president, and not knowing what's right. And of course, ego and ambition play into this. Pence clearly wants to be president someday. Barr clearly wants to salvage his reputation as a conservative. And so I get the fact that people were torn, but let's be careful about praising people as heroes when they could have come out much, much earlier. I'm glad we're hearing from people now. But look, ultimately, the people with real criminal exposure are not showing up at the committee. And they are, some have been charged already with contempt. Others will be. But then the dilemma with Mark Meadows, the chief of staff and executive privilege. We've seen Peter Navarro charged with contempt. So DOJ's got their hands full. But yeah, I mean, I the word hero is still something I'm very uncomfortable with.
Yeah,
we wouldn't have had the Capitol attacks if they came out and told us what was being plotted.
Exactly.
And that's
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
Speaking of that, you have Trump, you have Bannon, you have so many associates who are still running around. They have not been held accountable to date. They continue to plot. Bannon is literally, you know, for the past year, putting a call for every single election office to be taken by like the fringe right. You know, how dangerous is that? Because we know Hitler failed the first time, you know, and was successful the next time. Is anything being done to, you know, safeguard our elections to make sure that we do not have this type of attempt come 2024?
Oh, boy, this is perhaps the most disturbing question of all in terms of our future, because things are being put in place right now that make the future, even the midterms coming up in November and then ultimately the election again in 2024, they put them in great, great jeopardy. Because, you know, President Trump came out a while ago when he said something that's been a quote that's been attributed to Joe Stalin, whether it's accurate or not, I don't know. But he said something like, you know, it's not so important how the vote count comes out, but rather who's counting the votes. Mm-hmm. And that illustrates a strategy that's being run by Steve Bannon to put people in place at the Secretary of State level, to put people in place even at the county and local level, who are going to be registrars of voters and oversee election processes. And if you've got that in place, you can see a strategy where you don't even need to win. You simply need to create such chaos and question the credibility of the election process in key states where people are totally confused and challenge. This has just happened recently in the primary in New Mexico,
yes,
where, you know, local officials saying, yeah, I can't believe the primaries. There's something wrong with these machines. If you do that across the country,
across.
You have the potential for violent chaos come November.
Yeah, no, and he refused to certify the election, the GOP there. I mean, that's insanity, and that's just one, like, a simple taste of what is to come.
It's a strategy. Yeah. It's a plan.
Yeah, it's a specific strategy. Yeah, and starting right from the school board levels.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they've started right at the grassroots, school boards, the
whole thing. Steve Bannon has said, we're going local. That is his strategy. We're going local. And so it's funny because the American system, the beauty of it is that it's 50 different states. The federal government's not in charge of our elections. And we figured, hey, that sounds good, right? Because you can't have an authoritarian president putting his thumb on the scale of an election and running all the machines and running the whole thing with federal employees. That could be really abused. Well, now the 50 different ways of doing it are being, and it's more than 50 when you go county, local, right? Precinct by precinct, different voting machine company by different voting machine company. Now you have 1,000 ways you can exploit an election. Mm-hmm. And it comes down to the weakest link, and they're going to find it. And they have found it.
Yeah. And Bannon is an extremely dangerous guy. I mean, he much works, you know, alongside the ideology of Dugin, who's a fascist inside of Russia. And, you know, Orban, I believe he worked for or was, I think he did actually get the job for Orban over a few years ago. So, he's extremely. And then you remember in your own Italy, he was attempting, you know, to open a far right like monastery to have like a training camp.
He's working.
Which, thank God, Italy.
Yeah. I mean, he's
finally.
Yeah, no. But I mean, he's helping Meloni, who is the brothers of Italy. I mean, he's in deep with these people. So it's not, you know, like you were saying before, Frank, this is a problem of authoritarianism across the world.
Yes.
So I didn't want to interrupt you, but I mean, we have a problem here, too, you know, and it's extremely important. I'm glad, and I hope that Italians are also watching what is happening, because accountability is important.
Yes.
And getting this information, like shining a light on this information, right, is extremely important to show that, no, there is accountability in democracy. And I truly believe that it could be an example for other countries as well. All right, because the United States is immoral, right? I mean, this is happening. It's happening in the States.
We've lost a collective set of values. We seem to no longer share the same set of values. And that's a recipe for disaster. I think one of the lessons here, and particularly for my Italian, my friends in Italy, is how small a percentage of a country it takes. Yeah. Yeah. To cause this kind of conflict and chaos. You know, what we're talking 20-30% of Americans, you know, sticking with a party who represents authoritarianism and lies. And you might look at that and say, well, that's nothing to worry about. You still have the majority. No, because the majority is divided up amongst their own camps as well. And now we have a united 20-30% that's intent on wreaking havoc. That's all it takes. So, you know, my message to other nations is don't discount that minority that's organizing and strategizing and threatening, because it's for real.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's transnational. Yeah. It's transnational. They learn from each other. They use the same resources. They use the internet.
Russia.
So one thing that's posted in the United States. Exactly.
No, Russia's involved across the far-right movements in Europe and U.S.
Well, you talk about training. These violent extremist groups go overseas from America. Mm-hmm. They go to Eastern Europe and they train together.
Yeah.
Very scary proposition that these people are not only armed, but now are trained. And there is clear evidence that some of these violent extremists are in Ukraine now fighting. Mm-hmm. And, the prospect of combat experienced violent extremist Americans returning to our homeland after having had that kind of real life combat experience is really a daunting threat.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's another layer to it.
Yep.
That's another layer to it. Exactly.
Speaking of Russia, I have seen, and I mean, I follow the Russia side. I'm sure, you know, people who follow China see the same thing. I've seen a ramping up of disinformation operations targeting all our hot topic issues like transgender and the gas prices, inflation, guns, abortions. I mean, you name it, they're trying to divide us. And they've literally, I've seen over the past few weeks, them ramping up their efforts. And we see that they've also made a push prior in these efforts to kind of move it now from the online phase into a more violent phase. And with elections coming up, we're going to see, I mean, I'm honestly extremely worried about this summer. Mm-hmm. And apparently I'm not the only one because DHS issued a bulletin, a terror threat bulletin warning of domestic groups going violent and disinformation operations by Russia, China, and Iran. How do we protect from this? What can we do?
Yeah, no, for the first time in our history, we're facing a simultaneous threat, I think, like never before. By that, I mean a domestic threat that is augmented by the foreign threat coming together to split and divide us and really not being able to trust what's on our social media, where it's coming from. Whether it's a bot, a troll, whether it's Russian or China or Iranian, mm-hmm. we really have a Hydra multi-headed threat that we're facing. And yes, DHS was right, because when you look at the private extremist groups, violent extremist groups, what are they talking about right now? Well, things that we're in the middle of Pride Month right now, and yes, the whole anti-trans, anti-gender non-conforming thing is really reaching a crescendo. That seemed to have driven the Patriot Front in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. That drumbeat continues. This concept, and you say, well, what's the connection there? What's the connection between like a neo-fascist white nationalist group and anti-trans, anti-gay? The sense from the Patriot Front is that our freedoms have now are now going to be our fault, that freedom has gotten out of control, that we actually are so free that we're destroying ourselves with freedom, and they believe that's symbolized in trans gender prominence and gay rights. They think the whole concept of civil rights has gone too far. And the other thing DHS is watching closely is the Supreme Court is going to soon, if it, you know, it may happen right after we finish this conversation, is expected to overturn Roe v. Wade. And the concern there is that there's been talk of violence on both sides of that issue, by the way. But what really gets me, if you look at the Buffalo shooting at a supermarket driven by white replacement theory, and you look at the response to that shooting on extremist platforms, you know what a lot of those knuckleheads said was, well, I think, you know, yeah, that was a good shooting, but he may have wasted the experience. He probably should have gone to a pro-choice protest and shot those people. And you think, okay, again, what's the connection there? And the connection between white replacement theory and the abortion issue, well, what these people are articulating is that we're running out of white babies, white replacement theory, right? And if you are pro-abortion or pro-choice, then you are for less births in the United States. And somehow you now have become the enemy. So I think what DHS is concerned about is that what is anticipated is mass protests after Roe v. Wade is overturned, and those protests will become soft targets for violent extremists who want to hurt and kill people.
We saw this actually. You remember the police station that was set on fire? That it was actually white supremacists.
Yeah,
that's correct.
Exactly. They torched it themselves.
That's correct.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. Although everybody comes out and says, look at the horrible burning of police stations. Well, they forget to point out who did it. But
yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they saw, even with the supermarkets, I remember it was a white guy who walked around and broke all the windows at the time. And they were infiltrating Black Lives Matter. Although we have the far, you know, far left fringe part of it, too, because we have, you know, the Greenwalds and the Taibbis and others who support, again, pro-Kremlin talking points, even with Ukraine, with against law enforcement, against government, against, you know, everything.
So you can see, Olga, why DHS felt it necessary. And who knows all the intel they're seeing, right, that we don't see, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But saw it necessary to issue an advisory to law enforcement saying the next few months we will be in a heightened, more dynamic threat environment. It's that's a coded way of saying things are going to get worse before they get better.
And and my final question, how do we protect elections? Because we know with all of this chaos over the summer, potential chaos, and then with November and then with, you know, the far right Republican Bannon and Trump Republicans who are trying to attempt to take all the important positions in order to count the elections. And then you have Russia, China, and Iran who just want America to be destroyed and will interfere to not only take the protest more violent, but also to cause chaos around elections. What do we do to protect our elections?
Yeah, it's gotten a lot more complicated. The answer to that's gotten a lot more complicated because we, you know, we used to pat ourselves on the back and say, well, we've bolstered the state's cybersecurity. We've had DHS tipping off the states, even counties, saying you're being penetrated here. Fix this. Put this patch on your system. And you'll remember Chris Krebs, who headed CISA, the head of cybersecurity for DHS, came out and said, this was the most secure elections we've ever had with regard to the last presidential election. Well, what he meant, of course, was from a cyber perspective. But now, continuing the theme of a multi-headed threat, we don't just have a cyber threat to our elections. We have a human threat to our elections because, as we said, the strategy is to place people in key positions, local, county, and state, to include state secretaries of state. So one of the solutions there is, of course, to vote. I know people say this almost cavalierly, but you've got to get out and vote for the right people. The Secretary of State position is going to become the vital position. You could argue it's more important than the governor position at this point because they are really going to affect the outcome of an election, the credibility of it. And we need people running for office at county and local election level officials, volunteering. But also one of the things I hope that comes out of this January 6th committee is a to-do list. Things that the committee has observed in their investigation that need to get fixed. And one of them, it appears they're already discussing, is the need to fix and put enhanced security around how we select our electors, whether that needs to be revamped, whether it needs to largely go away and start over. But this notion that we could face the Electoral College ratification, like January 6th, and think that the vice president, one person, could throw out the whole election. That if there's any lack of clarity there, it needs to be clarified and written in stone with regard to this ridiculous notion that we can pick other electors, other than the official electors. All of this needs to be fixed. And the question is the will there to do that in this divided country of ours?
Yeah. Well, there are international efforts that are being made. I think I was listening to Maria Ressa speaking with Secretary Blinken not long ago, and she was saying that in the next 2 years, there are going to be 30 important elections in the world. And the information, there's going to be a lot more, at least this is the promise that had been made. There's a lot more, let's say, I'm talking from an international level, things that could impact the elections inside the United States. There will be a lot of cross-national, cross-transnational information that's going to be exchanged because we're going to be going through an election. you guys are going through an election, and what happens in the States is fundamental to other elections that are coming up. So, you know, this is, it was an interesting,
who's in power will change the fate of basically in the United States. Whoever wins 2024 will change the fate not only of Ukraine, but also, basically whether
we. In lots of countries.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's geopolitics. It'll be the stance we take toward Russia, the stance we take whether we support Ukraine or not. The whole notion of being a defender of democracy changes depending on who's in charge.
Definitely. Well, Frank, this has been so interesting. Also, do you have any more questions?
Nope.
No, we're done, right? Okay.
I always have questions, but
I know.
I could continue on and on. No, Frank, thank you so much for coming on, and thank you for, you know, answering these important questions and making it a lot more clear, especially for me with the media thing, with the DOJ watching, because the media makes it so like DOJ ignored the problem the past few years and now just tuned into the hearings. And I'm like, but that's how they made it sound. I'm like, that's
we're all impatient, right? We all want short-term gratification. We want somebody in handcuffs tomorrow. And it just doesn't work that way, but I'm confident that they're on it. What I'm not confident on, and nobody is clairvoyant, is if the evidence is there for Trump, to specifically charge Trump, will Merrick Garland make that very, very hard call? What's the balance of decision making there with the good of the country, the best interest of justice? But let's get there first and see what happens. But thank you for having me. Thanks for a great discussion. Thank you for what you both do to continue a civil dialogue across the globe, which is what we need.
Yep.
Thank you, Frank.
Hey, everybody. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to subscribe. And please visit our website, KremlinFile.com. This is a Bunker Crew Media production, hosted by Olga Lautman and me, Monique Camara, with executive producers Marley Clements, Jack Bryan, Grant DeSimone, Ben Brett, and Jordy Mycelis of Midas Media, with associate producers Ruby Frankel and Sarah Metz. Theme music by Oreste Camarra. Sound editing and mixing by Joy Ellett. Subscribe to Kremlin File wherever you listen to podcasts.